So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. Wisconsin not only got a new governor this week and Governor Tony Evers, but we got a new superintendent of public instruction and Carolyn Stanford Taylor, who has agreed to come and introduce herself. And welcome to Wisconsin Eye, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you very much. You're probably not very well known across the great state of Wisconsin, even though you've been a deputy superintendent for 17 years.
Assistant State Superintendent.
Thank you for the correction. So give us a little bit of your background. Now, I read on your bio you are from Marks, Mississippi.
Marks, Mississippi.
So how did you get here, please?
So I was in Marks, Mississippi, got a scholarship to Mississippi Valley State, stayed there for a semester and transferred to UW-Madison because I had a brother who had gotten a scholarship in engineering.
And he was raving about
Raving about UW-Madison
to come here.
And
okay.
How much
Excuse
a degree me. From UW would mean.
Okay.
So he convinced me to transfer in one of the coldest winters on record, January of 75.
So you graduate in elementary ed and you start teaching in the Madison School District. Do I have this right?
Not right away.
Okay.
So graduated elementary ed in 1978, went back to get my master's, completed that in 1979, worked for WPS as a training analyst for a year, and then to the Madison School District as a teacher.
What was the moment that you decided, I want to be a teacher? Were your parents, were either of your parents teachers?
My parents were not, but because I came from a large family, there were 14 of us. So basically, I was a teacher all my life.
Yes. Where were you in that birth order?
Number 9.
Number 9?
Number 9.
Okay. And you started out then teaching at what Madison School?
I started out at Frank Alice Elementary, and at that time it was a very small school, small staff. I think about 9 teachers on Buckeye Road. I was there for a year and then surplused. So I ended up at what's now Blackhawk, but at the time it was Gompers Middle School.
Right.
And I taught there for 9 years.
And you taught which grades?
I taught 6th grade for 6 years, which I dearly loved. And then 7th and 8th grade math and science for 3 years.
Then you became a principal where?
Madison School District. So I spent 21 years in the Madison School District. Okay. My first principalship was at Marquette Elementary School. I was there for 5 years. And during that time, there was some debate about splitting the two schools, creating a K-2, and a 3-5. So I led the 3-5. Did that for 5 years and then was asked to move to Lincoln Elementary School. And I was there for 6 years. And while at Lincoln, I opened Wright Middle School on Fish Hatchery Road.
And then in 2001, you joined the State Department of Public Instruction?
2001, came on board with Libby Burmaster.
Libby Burmaster.
Yes.
You now hold one of 6 constitutional statewide offices, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Why do you think the framers of Wisconsin, the pioneers, decided that their public instruction is so important, it should be one of 6 constitutional officers?
I think because they wanted to avoid the partisanship and that office needed to be an independent office that looked out for the best interests of kids and families without getting so involved in the political arena.
Now Governor Evers came to you and said, I'd like you to be the next superintendent. And why did you say yes? What opportunities do you see? What goals are you setting for the next couple of years?
I was excited because we're starting to embark on this area of mental health, looking at early childhood, all of those things that we know contribute to closing the gaps. So for me, my job wasn't done yet. And it was an opportunity to kind of lead the agency to the next phase.
What had you specialized in as, let me get the title right,
Assistant State Superintendent for Division of Learning Support.
And you oversaw special ed.
Special education.
And the governor said the budget he'll be submitting here in a few weeks is going to increase by $600 million, special ed.
Yes.
Why is that so critically important, ma'am?
Because our kids come to us with great needs. And we're not able to accommodate a lot of those needs because of resources. Some of our students are so involved that we need intense resources for them, and we're not able to do that to the degree that we really should be able to do it. So that's extremely important for our schools.
What are some of the specific special ed needs that you can cite? I mean, some of our, are you talking mental health issues or other issues?
Mental health is huge in that population. Part of my role in the Division of Learning Support is the two state schools, the School for the Blind, School for the Deaf. Mm-hmm. Mental health, especially among our deaf population of students, is a critical priority. But not just for that population, but in our schools in general. So in that budget, when we start to look at students who come with behavioral and emotional disabilities, schools are struggling to try to create collaborative relationships with agencies who can come in and assist, because we don't have a lot of the support staff in our schools that we really need. Psychologists, counselors, social workers. This will enable us to do some of those things that we haven't been able to do in the past.
You started your career teaching sixth graders.
I did.
How are sixth graders in 2019 different from sixth graders when you started teaching, ma'am?
Wow.
Additional pressures or just how has society changed the needs of those sixth graders?
And I think that's the real question. It's not so much that the kids have changed, it's the environment in which our kids are growing up. The pressures that are on our families today
Yes.
are very different from the pressures that were there when I was teaching those kids. And so we can't separate schools from communities. And what happens in communities impact what happens in the schools.
A teacher now, you started out as a teacher, but now teachers are also quasi-social workers? What
Yes.
else?
Yes. And every year we're asking them to do more and be more. And that's why it's so critical that we have the resources to bring in other supports. And when we look at mental health, that's what we're talking about. How do we wrap around services to our kids and our families? That's going to be critical in the coming years.
Do you think there's a growing need? I'm sorry. Do you think there's a growing awareness among policymakers of how the needs of our K-12 students have changed and evolved over the last 20 plus years?
I think they're beginning to see that. We saw in the past administration there was some work around trauma
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
ACEs, the adverse
Mrs.
childhood
Walker.
Experiences,
yes.
Mrs. Walker.
Yes.
And our work at the agency around trauma-informed schools.
Yes.
And starting to provide resources and technical assistance to the schools in order to assess where students were so that we know the level of supports. So we're seeing more of that.
Congratulations, and I think you're the third African-American to hold statewide office.
Wow.
Do you consider yourself a pioneer like Vel Phillips and now Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes?
It is also overwhelming. You know, when you step into roles like that, it's not because you're considering I'd be the third African-American. It's where your passion is and what you believe that you can contribute. And that's what I've done all my life. And I'm just hearing recently about these firsts. Well, did you know you were the first of this and the first of that? That was not what motivated me.
What perspective do you bring as an African American to the job of Superintendent of Public Instruction, ma'am?
I think looking back over my background and how I was raised and where I came from the segregated South, which we were in schools that were poorly resourced. I came from a large family, a family that lived in poverty. And by today's standards, I would have been labeled at risk because of all of those things. And to have come through that and recognize what got me to where I am today, I think that's what I bring, because I can look back and see there was advocacy on certain levels from certain people. There was a dedication to education. There were hardworking people who sacrificed to get me to where I am. But I also look at other families who integrated schools with mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. And there was just a handful of families that integrated schools in Marks, Mississippi at that time. And I saw that many of those students did not succeed or were not able to achieve at the same level that I was, and began to ask the question of why. And when you start to unpack that, you realize these are some of the same supports that we need for our kids today. We need caring and nurturing adults who are in their lives. We need to recognize that they all come with strengths and talents and skills, and we're the ones who have to uncover that for them.
Was there a specific teacher early in your elementary school days who said, you can do this, I want you to dream, I want you to have a vision, believe in yourself? Was there someone like that?
My first teacher was my mom, because okay. she was always my advocate.
Right.
And everything was, you can, you will. But I did have, if I go back to the early days and thinking about when we were segregated, I had teachers who looked like me, who believed in me. Even though they didn't have the resources that the other schools had, they did the best that they could to instill in us a can-do attitude. And because it was community, they knew your parents, they knew you were accountable, and they were accountable. So that got me so far. And then when we integrated schools, yes, of course, there were people in my life who recognized talent that I didn't even know that I had.
Who believed in you. Yep.
Who believed in me.
Talent you didn't even know you had.
I didn't know I had.
Right.
There was an 11th grade English teacher who said, wow, you have a gift for writing. I never considered that. And from then on, it was, I'm a writer.
I had a 6th grade teacher tell me that, and I went, oh, I can? Oh, this is great. Maybe I'll become a reporter. But
doesn't
anyway,
that make an impact on your life?
It sure does. Your career has been Madison-based.
Yes.
Do you feel you have a need of, I'm sorry, do you feel you have a perspective on the needs of Wisconsin rural schools, which are have unique distance and other needs?
Yes. In my 17 and a half years at the agency, I've been able to travel to places to bring in people on committees and councils and work with people who have the rural perspective. Mm-hmm. And always when we're looking at funding or new initiatives, we're trying to bring in the rural people. So we want to make sure that geographically we're touching urban, suburban, and rural.
I have this question, and it's a very important question. Why is the opportunity gap racially in Wisconsin, if not the highest in the nation, among the highest, Superintendent?
That's a good question. I think until a few years ago, we didn't call it what it was. Mm-hmm. We hid under its poverty, its parents, and we often want to point the finger at parents, if they would only. But it's coming to the realization that when we disaggregate data and we really start to do the deep dive and look at what we see, who's left out, what are those subpopulations that are not being affected. And I think you probably heard that when we look at poverty and we account for poverty, that our African-American kids who live a more affluent life don't do as well as some of our poor white kids.
I read that, yeah, in a study.
Yes.
How can Wisconsin begin to improve, to close this, whether we call it the achievement gap, the opportunity gap, I don't care what you call it. It's a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
Steps that Wisconsin could take to close that, ma'am?
I think it's a many-tentacled beast. There are a number of variables that contribute to the gap.
Mm-hmm.
I think early childhood is one of the ways to look at that, because our students come to us with deficits. If we look at where our youngest children are being provided childcare and what happens in those environments, a lot of times people are doing the best that they can, and we're not pointing fingers at that.
Mm-hmm.
But many of our children come to us with language deficits because they're not hearing, they're not being involved in authentic kind of learning experiences. So they come in with this disadvantage. So there are some things we can do on the front end, right? 4K, 3K, if we're looking at some of our large urbans where we're identifying these gaps.
Yes.
If we start early, then we don't end up on the back end looking at the criminal justice system and how we fix and create and rehabilitate those folks to come back and be contributing members of our society.
To get ready for this show, I should have done this research, so I hope you know the answer. What percentage of our K-12 districts offer K-4? Is it?
I don't have that number. I know it's a high percentage. Almost all of them.
Almost all of them. Thank you. And should Wisconsin take the next step to look at some K-3? Because that comes with funding questions and dollars.
Absolutely.
But what do the studies show? Most children by age 4 are so far developed that you really have to address it at age 3 and age 4? Isn't that kind of what studies show?
I can't quote that study.
Okay. MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools.
Yes.
4-year graduation rate for African-American males, only 60%. Mm-hmm. We're losing generations, aren't we?
We are.
You have thought, undoubtedly, in your 17 and a half years with DPI, about MPS. Next step to help improve that 4-year graduation rate, Superintendent?
Yes. And let me just say, Milwaukee, like many areas, have pockets of excellence, and I've seen it. I've been there. I've walked into schools where I've said, I would send my own child here, and mm-hmm. that's always my standard. Mm-hmm. So there are some great things happening in Milwaukee. We've been working with Milwaukee a lot around attendance. Back in 2004, we created this Alliance for Attendance with Milwaukee. The communities were ready. We had faith-based, we had philanthropists, we had business community. All of those folks came together to address what seemed to be the issue at that time. But I think more than that, we have to figure out ways to engage our students, to make learning more meaningful for them, to create environments where they feel safe and protected and nurtured, that they want to be in, that they feel like they have some ownership of. So those are the kinds of things we're working on right now to try to build those in. And, of course, you have to work with the adults. The adults are the ones that we're depending on to create those systems.
You've heard the debate in terms of MPS. It's not about throwing money at MPS. It's about other change, perhaps in governance. What are your thoughts? Does it go beyond throwing additional money at MPS?
I think money is always critical. But I believe it has to be a conversation and an initiative where all stakeholders are involved in what happens with MPS. One of the things that we're doing now, we have the Big Five initiative. We're looking at urban school districts and having those leaders come together because they have more things in common than not. And they can help to start developing and addressing what the needs of large urbans are. And we're working with them on that.
This dialogue over the classical K-12 education and blending now the needs of the workforce of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And so how do we blend? Governor Walker was a champion of job apprenticeships. What are your thoughts on how we take used to be the classical K-12, you graduate in 12th grade, mm-hmm. and then you perhaps go to a tech college or a 4-year. How do we blend that with the needs of training up the next workforce for Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. And we know that our students generally take different paths. There are some who are on the path to 4-year college. Some who want to go to 2-year colleges to get a technical degree, mm-hmm. and others who want to graduate and go into the workforce immediately. But we have partnerships. We have business partnerships now that are working with schools and doing great things, creating those opportunities for students to get in and get a look and a feel at what does it mean to work in this industry. We also have things that are going on in the schools. So with our academic preparation, or I'm sorry, I'm not coming up with the term for it now, but at sixth grade, we're allowing our kids to start to think about careers.
Yes.
Not that we're forcing them to make a decision about careers, but they get an opportunity to kind of explore what the universe is. And I know in my education, in my experience, we didn't have that. It was limited basically to what we could see.
Mm-hmm.
And now these students are being able to look at skills and interests that they have and seeing where they might be transferable to different kinds of jobs. So we're creating all kinds of opportunities for them.
You used to teach sixth graders. Do they want to begin to think about potential careers? How do you introduce that into their thinking with all else that's going on with the sixth grade mind?
I think more than you know, they really are. I have a number of students that I taught in fifth and sixth grade who are in education now. And when they come back, they say, "You're the reason I'm in education. You're the reason I chose to go into education." So they're seeing things, whether they're formulating that thought right now that this is what they want to be, it's in their head, it's percolating.
17 and a half years at DPI, let me ask you this perspective. Looking back over the last 8 years, in the wake of Act 10, do Wisconsin teachers feel devalued, Superintendent?
I believe so.
How critical was that? Is that damage to their morale?
Very damaging, to the point where some educators were not promoting others to go into the field of education.
Is that still going on?
I think we're turning a corner. I believe that those people who remained in education, who were dedicated to teaching and molding young minds, are still there. They're still encouraging others, even with everything that's going on swirling around them. I think during that time of Act 10, it was a blow. Educators were devalued. Felt devalued.
Did we lose some of our best and brightest K-12 teachers?
I think we probably lost a few, but I would grant you that we still have a tremendous number of brightest and best in our classrooms.
But when I read news stories showing that fewer are enrolling in elementary ed, mm-hmm. at our mm-hmm. colleges and universities, does it concern you as some of our older teachers are now retiring? Are we going to be able to fill those jobs?
I think we will. I think we're looking at some of the barriers to them becoming educators, because now we're seeing other adults who've been in the workforce for a while who are very interested in changing careers and becoming teachers. And so we're starting to kind of fish for those folks as well.
Well, next spring, if you're addressing the graduates at UW-Madison, and they're getting degrees in elementary education,
yes.
and they're well aware of the history of Act 10, what's your elevator speech to get them to stay with K-12 public schools?
Wow. The ability to change the trajectory of a life. And I would be the example of what an educator can promote someone to do.
Wasn't it Krista McAuliffe who said, "I shape the future, I teach"?
Yes.
Before we lost her in that tragic
yes.
accident. You brought up the issue of school safety. Unfortunately, Columbine ushered in a very tragic
yes.
series of attacks in our schools. Do you welcome the $100 million initiative that, I'm going to use the Attorney General's term, hardened our schools? Or did that give our K-12 students one more thing to worry about?
I think the dollars that were given to the schools mm-hmm. served a purpose in comforting our communities a bit and our students somewhat. But I think there are lots of preventative things we can do. Again, when we create those safe environments where students don't feel like bullying is part of their culture, that they can step up and speak up, that they have caring adults that they can go to, that we've taught them social-emotional competencies so that it's not all about me. I live within a community. And when we create communities in our classrooms and in our schools, and they know that everyone is there pushing for the best for them, mm-hmm. I think that more than anything creates the safe environment that we're seeking.
You helped then Superintendent Evers and now Governor Evers draft his budget.
Yes.
And he has said the budget he submits to the legislature is going to increase spending on K-12 by $1.4 billion.
Yes.
When you testified before the Joint Finance Committee about why they should approve a budget that is an increase of $1.4 billion, and one of members of finance, what difference will it make if we approve this $1.4 billion? How are you going to answer?
I think it goes back to part of what we were talking about with our special education population. But not just that. The mental health in schools or mental health of our students that not just schools are talking about, but the whole community is talking about. And then there's money for support staff, the counselors, psychologists, social workers that many schools don't have. A lot of them do. Many don't. If we look at the staff-to-student ratios and where we are as a state versus what's recommended, mm-hmm. We're lacking. And then the other piece that's in there is after school. So if we're really concerned about where our students are and if they're in productive environments, that's another area that we should be looking at. Right now, we get dollars from the federal government to create the community learning centers. And it's not enough dollars to go around. The state has not invested in that. We're asking the state to make an investment in after school for our kids.
In your career in Wisconsin, you've watched the CHOICE program, the voucher program, being approved for Milwaukee, now we're seeing now statewide. Do you think it should be frozen where it is, or should we begin to scale it back, Superintendent?
I think if we're going to support two systems, then we need to appropriately fund both of them, or appropriately fund public education, because those dollars for vouchers are coming out of the public education pot of money. It's not an increased pot. So if we're committed to doing that, then we need to appropriately fund public education.
The champions of CHOICE say CHOICE students generally get a better education than if they were in a K-12 school. Do you agree? The testing seems to be all over the map, the evaluations. Your response?
I don't agree.
Okay.
Our public schools are doing a fantastic job. Being under-resourced creates barriers and challenges for them. So that's one reason I'm saying we can't keep taking dollars and expect them to do a yeoman's job. We need to invest in our public schools. And when we invest, we will see all of those great things that we've been talking about.
You have a chance to finish out what had been Mr. Evers' term. Is it your intent to seek a full term 2 years from now? That's a long way from now.
I'm not saying no yet.
You're not saying no.
I'm not saying no.
What's going to determine whether you do that?
The first year.
The first year?
Yes.
And your top goal in the first year?
We're going to push this equity agenda. We're going to ratchet it up a notch.
You sound pretty excited about your new job.
I am very excited.
Okay. Thank you very much. Carolyn Stanford Taylor is the new Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction just this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.